Well, we're going to begin by taking a look at, in a sense, the theme of tonight's broadcast is going to be echoes of the past and the present. We're going to take a look at just how the current military economy, the garrison state of America, has come into being, and we're going to take a look at a couple of echoes of some of this country's past assassinations. And interestingly enough, we're going to take a very long, unpleasant, and penetrating look at current Democratic vice presidential candidate Lloyd Bentsen, a fellow who has some very interesting connections, and in as much as he will be sitting behind Michael Dukakis, should Dukakis pull it out, it might be worth taking a look at Lloyd Bentsen. Anyway, we're going to begin by taking a look at a recent obituary, Albert Jenner, who served as the senior counsel for the Republicans during the Watergate Committee and also was a key Warren Commission counsel as well. The links between Watergate and the John F. Kennedy assassination being massive and pivotal for both events, really, when looked at from the 2020 vision of hindsight. We're going to take a look at another one of the key Galen alumni who has turned up on the ethnic wing of the Bush campaign and has resigned. This is an interesting fellow with ties to the anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations in the OUN Bandera, one of the many Galen organs which has connections to the John F. Kennedy assassination and which figures in part of the propagandizing which was used to create the official story. We'll talk about that at considerable length. Then we're going to go to a book called Forgive My Grief, Volume 4, by Penn Jones, and we're going to take a look at a very important institution which we have not discussed too much in the past. That institution is the Defense Industrial Security Command, which has since been renamed the Defense Investigative Service. This essentially is the intelligence organization which provides the security clearances for people that work in the defense industry. It also, according to a number of writers who have investigated its machinations, has essentially evolved into a fusion of the National Security Establishment and organized crime. It figures prominently in a number of unsavory activities, including this country's major political assassinations and drug trafficking, according to these same investigators. We're going to take a look at the Defense Industrial Security Command and its powerful links to Lloyd Bentsen, its role in financing Bentsen's first campaign. And then we're going to look at a magnificent piece of research that comes to us from Mabe Russell and through Mabe Russell, namely the article in the Hudson Valley Chronicle by David Wimple discussing some of the implications of a very important affidavit submitted by a man named Robert Byron Watson. Robert Byron Watson was deposed with regard to some key information he had about the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King. We took a look at this article at considerable length in Radio Free America No. 8, our archive show about the assassination of Martin Luther King. Tonight's program is going to go in as sort of a supplement, into the archives, I should say, as sort of a supplement to RFA No. 8. We're going to take a look at some interesting speculation by David Wimple concerning parallels between the story presented by Robert Byron Watson and what is known about the Defense Industrial Security Command. We're going to see some hard connections between the people involved in the assassination of John F. Kennedy and apparently also, at least possibly involved in the assassination of Martin Luther King. We're also going to see a number of structural similarities between some of the patterns in the assassination of Martin Luther King and what we know about the operations, in particular vis-a-vis the assassinations, of the Defense Industrial Security Command. We're going to take a look at the connections, at Robert Byron Watson's testimony that Carlos Marcello, New Orleans capo mafioso and a certain participant in the assassination of John Kennedy, was present at a meeting that he overheard people discussing the assassination of Martin Luther King. Another interesting connection we're going to look at is the connection between Eugene Hale Brading, or Jim Braden, as he was also known, a fellow stopped by police in Dealey Plaza just after the assassination of Robert Kennedy, a fellow with connections to the Hunts, to the organized crime syndicate, in particular the Cleveland branch of Mo Dalitz. And interestingly enough, this fellow also apparently had connections to Jack Youngblood, the soldier of fortune who appears to many investigators to have been the actual trigger man in the assassination of Martin Luther King. And we're going to look at some of the interesting places that Eugene Hale Brading has been, and also discuss some other people that have moved in those same circles. We're going to close by taking another dip into the Jesse Jackson file, actually making another addition to the Jesse Jackson file, as long-time listeners or even short-time listeners know. I do not think that Jesse Jackson is what he represents himself as being at all. I think, in fact, the man is an intelligence agent, almost certainly with connections to the assassination of Dr. King, and a person who, in my estimation, is fulfilling the strategic role that, at least to the best of our knowledge, was coined for the first time in 1968 with the use of CIA agent Senator Eugene McCarthy to split the liberal vote and thereby give Richard Nixon a narrow victory over Hubert Humphrey. In many elections since, the national security establishment has dredged up a spoiler to basically use an electoral application of the old military strategy, divide and conquer, to split up some of the component spectra of the liberal political constituency in this country. And in my estimation, Jesse Jackson is just such an individual. I'm not going to even attempt to go into all the various pieces of information that have led me in this direction. We'll talk about it briefly when the time comes. Suffice it to say that Jesse has now been seen in New York hobnobbing with none other than Donald Trump, a multi-billionaire, a conservative Bush supporter, and an interesting individual in and of himself. And apparently the relationship is more than just a casual one. And it has led some people to, some people other than myself, I should say, to speculate that part of the association may have to do with dissatisfaction on Jackson's part with Michael Dukakis and even a desire to see Dukakis lose. As I say, that is the speculation of a society columnist that we see here. We've already seen a series of articles a month or two ago about Jesse's open dissatisfaction with the Dukakis campaign and stories about how there was a great deal of friction between the two camps, and some people in the Dukakis campaign supposedly seeing Jesse Jackson as a liability in certain parts of the country. Again, I mention this because we're now seeing some of the same things that I have been saying for a long time coming from other people, although they are not seeing an intelligence connection there, simply by way of food for thought and grounds for further research. So that's what we're going to wind up with, another trip to the Jesse Jackson file.
All right, and starting off, we are going to be reading a short article, an obituary actually, as mentioned, from the San Francisco Chronicle for Monday, September 19th of 1988. The obituary is for Albert Jenner, J-E-N-N-E-R, and it's Dateline Chicago. Attorney Albert Jenner, the chief Republican counsel in the congressional impeachment proceedings against President Richard Nixon, died at age 81 yesterday after a long illness. Jenner, considered an expert on the field of evidence in federal cases, also served as senior counsel to the Warren Commission investigation of the assassination of President John Kennedy and as a member of the National Commission on the Causes and Prevention of Violence.
Rather ironic, that last little item.
I was going to say, we probably don't have time to fully detail it tonight, but there's an incredible congruity, more even than would be warranted, I think, by anybody believing in coincidence, between people involved in, reputed to be involved in, the Kennedy assassination and people involved or reputed to be involved with the Watergate case, a large overlap, starting with, of course, some of the most famous Watergate people, like the plumbers themselves, Frank Sturgis, etc., or Frank Fiorini, as he is sometimes known, but and E. Howard Hunt, but of course stretching much farther than that.
Yeah, the cast of characters in the John F. Kennedy assassination and the Watergate scandal overlap to an enormous extent. It's the view of many people that Richard Nixon was in fact unhorsed by the CIA itself, and that the vehicle for unhorsing him was his obvious involvement in the assassination of John Kennedy. As I say, it's the same cast of characters. We went into that at considerable length in Radio in Guns of November program number 3, although the Jenner connection itself was not in there. That will, however, be in the remake of Guns of November, which will be coming up in the not-too-distant future. Not necessarily in November because, as I say, I'm going to be taking a short sabbatical of roughly a month, give or take a week, when May does in fact pass away. There's no way of knowing for sure when that's going to happen, but it's going to be pretty soon to allow for some practical details to be taken care of and also basically to allow me to regroup after a very heavy blow of that type, because I'm going to continue here, but at the same time, Superman, I ain't. So we'll be going into Guns of November number 3, along with the rest of the Guns of November, an expanded, new and improved Guns of November it will be, including a lot of the material from our archive shows, 11, 12, 13, 15, and others. So that'll be coming up in the not-too-distant future. At any rate, another echo of the John F. Kennedy assassination, which bears directly on the current presidential campaign, from two Sundays ago, Sunday, September 11th, This is an article in the San Jose Mercury News by David Lee Preston of the Knight Ridder News Service, headline, "Several Bush Volunteers May Have Anti-Semitic Ties." Recall a couple of weeks ago we dealt with some material concerning people on the Bush Ethnic Organizations Committee. I've forgotten off the top of my head what it's called. The National Republican Heritage Groups Council is the parent organization. But anyway, a lot of the people on the Bush Ethnic Committee are Galen alumni, literally Third Reich alumni, who jumped to the United States along with the Galen organization, Hitler's Eastern Front Intelligence Organization, and have then wormed their way up into mainstream Republican politics from their vantage point of as operatives for U.S. intelligence. We talked about that at considerable length a couple of weeks ago, related it directly to some material from Blowback. So those of you who meet with continued skepticism can simply refer people from recent headlines directly to Blowback. The Galen connections to the national security establishment are not something of the past, but are as current as the presidential campaign that's occupying so much attention. However, there's a name in this particular article that was not in the New York Times article from 9/9/88. Skipping down into the article, Bohdan Fedorak, Bohdan Fedorak, National Ethnic Vice Chairman of Ukrainians for Bush. He is head of external affairs in the United States for the Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists Bandera, said by historians to be a Nazi collaborationist organization linked to anti-Polish and anti-Jewish wartime pogroms. Fedorak is a leader of an organized campaign to dismantle the Justice Department's Nazi hunting arm, the Office of Special Investigations. On July 20th, Fedorak introduced Bush to a joint meeting of the Detroit Captive Nations Committee and the Anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations at the Ukrainian Cultural Center in Warren, Michigan. Bush nodded and applauded when Fedorak denounced the Special Investigations Office, according to Russell Ballant, a Detroit-based researcher and writer who attended the meeting as an observer. Well, the OUN Bandera and the Anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations are organizations which link the current Bush campaign, and there is previous information from both the San Francisco Examiner and the Nation magazine to link George Bush himself to the Kennedy assassination. But in short, the OUN Bandera, the Ukrainian nationalist organization which contributed mightily both to the Waffen-SS and to the Holocaust, Hitler's liquidation of the Jews as it happened on the Eastern Front, and that organization then jumped to CIA/Galen. We talked about that at great length in Radio Free America program number 1. The Bandera people figured prominently in the development of the special forces. They were shepherded into the country or into the national security establishment by Frank Wisner at considerable length. And as we looked at in RFA number 15, the assassination of Stefan Bandera himself. Bandera had been working for Galen, had begun doing a lot of moonlighting with the British, which apparently irked Galen enough to apparently have him disposed of. However, the killing was blamed on the KGB in a rather far-fetched scenario in which a broken key in the hands of a Soviet agent named Bogdan Stashinsky happened to be linked with another half of the broken key, which had stayed in the same lock for a year and a half, which is an awfully long stretch of time. At any rate, the assassination of Bandera was used by a number of ultra-right-wing and fascist elements, many of which were to recombine, or were to formally combine, in the World Anti-Communist League a few years later to set up a scenario in which the Soviet Union was being implicated in the assassination of President Kennedy. Basically, the story went that the Soviet Union had developed an assassination team which was disposing of its enemies abroad. The Bandera killing was cited as one of them, and there were a lot of stories floated by people like Charles Kirsten, an eventual Wackel affiliate who served as Mrs. Bandera's attorney, yet at the trial of Bogdan Stashinsky, that in fact the Soviets were behind the assassination of John Kennedy. This was one of the many elements used to paint Oswald red, so to speak, which tended to the red cover given documented CIA agent Oswald was used to deflect those people who might have been inclined to look into the conspiracy theory. They were told, never mind, there'll be a Third World War if people know that the Ruskies shot Kennedy, so you best not look into it. Of course, the Anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations was the organization that formally welcomed Lee Harvey Oswald into the United States in spite of his apparent treason to the United States and the doctrinaire fanatical anti-communism and fascism of its members. Specifically, Spaz Rakin of the Friends of the Anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations welcomed Lee Harvey Oswald, the supposed communist and Marxist sympathizer and supposed traitor, into the United States, and ultra-right-wing Ukrainians and ABN affiliates, people with undocumented links to the U.S. intelligence community, were instrumental in handling also Marina Oswald after the assassinations of John Kennedy and Lee Oswald. We took a look at George Bue and Ilya Mamontov, a fanatical right-wing Ukrainian, and their role in helping to shepherd Marina Oswald after the assassination. The point being that the very same fascists that we're now seeing being purged from the Bush campaign helped place this the current team of reactionaries in office in 1963. This same organization had helped dispatch many of the victims of Adolf Hitler. In fact, we even saw the links between Theodor Oberlander, a key SS man and former Adenauer cabinet official, with the OUN Bandera. Oberlander was the commander of an OUN Bandera element that called the Einsatzgruppe Nachtigall, the Nightingale Group, which dispatched all of the Jewish population of Lvov, or Lemberg, as it Lvov, as it's called in Ukrainian, Lemberg, as it was known when it was part of Poland. We then see Theodor Oberlander, along with Charles Willoughby, MacArthur's G2, and himself a German-born doctrinaire fascist named Karl Adolf Wiedenbach. We see these same individuals. We see Theodor Oberlander, Charles Willoughby, and Nelson Bunker Hunt belonging to the Committee for the Defense of Christian Culture. Recall that Hitler promised to preserve Christian values. And it's a very interesting connection. Again, this is a long and complex connection. We documented that in RFA number 15, also Guns of November number 4, about some of the Nazi connections. The point being, once again, this is not something that happened a long time ago. This is something which happened a long time ago and has proceeded to date.
Indeed. Again, just to make the point, it's sort of one of the, one of the subtext of all of our broadcasts is that the past is still alive, and it's still very much affecting the present. As a matter of fact, the past is a part of the present.
As Harry Truman said, the news is just a history you haven't learned yet.
That's right, and boy, it's happening all around us. Lest anybody think that all we do on this show is kick Jesse Jackson and George Bush. Dan Quayle, obviously not even worth the effort to lift one's foot, but we're going to talk a little bit about the Democratic vice presidential nominee.
You know, and why don't we take a short musical break at this point? Before
might not be a bad idea.
The bulk of the broadcast, that'll give me a chance to change the tape.
That might not be a bad idea at all, especially since we're creeping up on the top of the hour, and then plus I can go and...
You can sniffle, and I can stretch, and it'll serve as a nice...
Big fun.
Yeah, it'll serve as a nice discontinuity before the main archival part of tonight's broadcast.
All right, we shall do that. We shall take a break, and in just a few minutes, Dave Emery and myself, Nip Tuck, will return with more of One Step Beyond. We've been talking tonight, thus far, in so much as we've begin to develop any sort of larger theme for the show. We've been talking tonight about, as we often do, about the fact that seemingly distant events, at least distant in terms of time, are nonetheless extremely important for understanding the present. And we've been talking about things like the group of revanchist Eastern Europeans that one might, if one was not quite so polite, call basically unregenerate fascists, that have made themselves at home within the Republican Party and who have played such a key a role in showing up during the present presidential campaign. And we've talked about the fact that not only are these people, as we said, revanchist Eastern European types, former collaborators or active supporters of the Nazis, but that in many cases they are also been connected to American political tragedies like the assassination of John F. Kennedy, the Watergate affair, and more recently, of course, we mentioned briefly at the beginning of the show, the Iran-Contra case, through which these particular anti-democratic, anti-communist, but which really means anti-democratic, in their case, types have cropped up all through it. We mentioned Otto von Bolschwing. We didn't mention Gerhard Mertens, but we'll mention him now and his connections to Otto Skorzeny, Hitler's commando, and a variety of folks of this sort who've showed up throughout the Iran-Contra scandal and are, in fact, movers and shakers in American policy.
Well, they've showed up on the Bush campaign, as for those who eventually hear this on tape, they showed up on the Bush campaign in September of 1988, and they apparently that sort of political philosophy is something which has been rooted within the Republican Party for some time. Another key Bush aide, Fred Malek, was forced to resign from the Bush campaign after basically conducting a Joseph Goebbels-type purge of the Bureau of Labor Statistics, purging it of a Jewish cabal, quote-unquote. And again, it is not a philosophy alien to this country. We're going to be talking this evening about some links between the past and the present. We're going to be talking about an organization called the Defense Industrial Security Command. That's what it was called in 1963, when elements of it figured prominently in the assassination of John Kennedy. It is now called the Defense Investigative Service. This is the organization, and it's very, very secretive, that provides the security clearances for people who work in the defense industry. According to a number of researchers who have looked into it, it is far more than that, and literally serves as a fusion of organized crime and the U.S. National Security Establishment, the military and intelligence services, and has been involved in a prominent way not only in big-time drug trafficking, but also the systematic assassination of much of America's progressive leadership, notably the Kennedy brothers and Martin Luther King.
Just a little liberal arts note here of interest. As we mentioned, the Defense Industrial Security Command has gone from being DISC DISC to DIS. Interestingly enough, DIS DIS is in classical mythological terms is another name for hell. So we can make of that what we will.
One of the reasons that we study one of the major topics of this broadcast is this country's political assassinations, and one of the reasons we study them as thoroughly and repeatedly as we do is that essentially on November 22nd, 1963, although mainstream American intellectual culture has not properly recorded it, a profound event occurred in this country, which was literally a coup d'etat of an explicitly fascist nature. The military and intelligence services had had enough of John Kennedy's peacemaking, both actual and proposed, and simply decided that they were no longer going to take a back seat to the civilian portion of our government, as Douglas MacArthur had been forced to do, and basically they overthrew it. Kennedy was in the process of pulling us out of Vietnam. He was in the process of normalizing relations with Castro's Cuba, which was going to be moving toward a truly unaligned status, although it is nominally unaligned today. It is obviously a close ally of the Soviet Union. Kennedy had been moving in a lot of other directions as well, was proposing to break up the CIA into 1,000 pieces in his second administration, and had worked out the first substantive arms control agreement in history with the Soviet Union, namely the Atmospheric Test Ban Treaty, which had occurred in August of 1963. He infuriated not only American munitions makers, but also the old boys from Peenemunde by proposing joint space exploration with the Soviet Union, something we now see being proposed today. There actually was a joint flight in the 70s. However, in 1963, that was anathema. And for that, those and other reasons, the National Security Establishment disposed of John F. Kennedy. Assassinations and near assassinations have dominated American politics ever since. We have only to go back to 1980 to see the shooting of Allard Lowenstein, the killing of Allard Lowenstein, which affected the Democratic primary campaign, which seriously weakening and no doubt intimidating Ted Kennedy, who was challenging Jimmy Carter. We also saw the curious death of Nelson Rockefeller, eliminating the only serious opposition that Ronald Reagan figured to see from within the Republican Party, the so-called liberal, unquote, wing of the Republican Party. Shortly after Reagan was elected, of course, an American, a former member of the American Nazi Party named John Hinckley, the Hinckley family having strong connections to the Bush family, shot President Reagan. Of course, had President Reagan died, George Bush would have become the most powerful man in the United States. The fact of the matter is, in 1972, as we saw with our program about the shooting of George Wallace, serious primary opposition or eventual third-party opposition, I should say, to Richard Nixon was eliminated by gunfire. Although we don't know precisely who shot George Wallace, we do know it certainly wasn't Arthur Bremer. The paraffin tests were negative. Therefore, the official version of history, as it is with our other assassinations, is a readily demonstrable lie. 1968 was perhaps the most dramatic, where the assassinations first of Martin Luther King and then of Robert Kennedy completely eliminated the significant progressive leadership in this country at that time. There were other leaders, some of them extremely talented, but none of that stature. And essentially the big three at that point was gone. John Kennedy's elimination just before the beginning of 1964, of course, having eliminated him. But the same institutions which have given us all of these blasts from the past, and I mean that quite literally, are still very much on the scene. in another archive show, which is available from Archives on Audio, the role of the death of Willie Velasquez, an absolutely monumental American Latino leader, was evaluated against the background of this country's political assassinations. I myself, and it was proposed in that broadcast, which is actually a composite of two programs, that Velasquez's death, Velasquez being the head of the Southwest Voter Registration and Education Project and a prospective Dukakis campaign manager, Willie Velasquez died of galloping cancer shortly before the end of the primary campaign. This seriously, in the eyes of the Dukakis campaign, weakened their prospects in California and Texas in particular, and it was then felt that the selection of Lloyd Benson as a vice presidential nomination compensated for the damage of the loss of Willie Velasquez in Texas. Inasmuch as the national security establishment has, as a matter of record, had the ability to give people cancer since 1954, we know this from Freedom of Information Act documents, and I think it can be safely assumed that 30 years plus of medical technology have made those means far more sophisticated today. The death by galloping cancer of Willie Velasquez, I think, is to be examined as a possible political assassination, and, in my opinion, was a key element in the political maneuvering which put Lloyd Benson right behind Michael Dukakis. Although Dukakis has encountered a lot of flack during the campaign for not being liberal enough, who knows what it is exactly that he's going to do should he get elected. It should also be remembered that 1988 is not 1968, and that anyone who wants to get elected today is going to have to at least assuage the fears of the huge, huge defense constituency in this country, not just the military themselves, but the large numbers of Americans who, under Ronald Reagan, have basically been put to work in sort of a military Keynesian program, basically the same sort of government jobs program which liberals had espoused, except instead of being done in the private sector, it was done through the military. 54 cents of every dollar now goes to the military, and America has been turned in 8 years from the world's greatest creditor nation to the world's biggest debtor nation to finance this military buildup. Should Michael Dukakis, once elected president, if he gets elected, proved to be what John Kennedy was, someone who, although campaigning on a national security platform, actually turned out to be a peacemaker, this will not sit well with the people who make their money from weapons, and it will not sit well from the people who get their kicks out of using those weapons. We're going to take a look at Lloyd Benson, the man who sits behind Michael Dukakis, and his connections with an organization which one doesn't hear much about, but one should hear a great deal about, namely, what used to be called the Defense Industrial Security Command. It is now the Defense Investigative Service, an organization elements of which figured prominently, according to a document we've used in the past, in the John F. Kennedy assassination, and according to that document, they also affected the assassinations of John and Robert Kennedy. We're going to take a look at Lloyd Benson's connections to the Defense Industrial Security Command, something about the nature of that organization, and we also, incidentally, will touch on its campaign financing of a former grade B movie actor who went on to become, I'm told, governor of California, someone named Reagan.
That's right. Nobody ever heard of him again.
Yeah, I guess after becoming governor of California, he no longer felt ambitious enough to pursue further office.
Well, it was obviously a fluke he got that far. We're going to read a short segment here from a book entitled Forgive My Grief, Volume 4. Forgive My Grief, the series of books, come from the pen of, well, literally, of Penn Jones, Jr. Penn Jones, Jr. was the editor of a small East Texas newspaper called the Midlothian Mirror. Penn Jones was one of the first people to stand up and say, we're getting jobbed by the Warren Commission and by the investigation into the John F. Kennedy assassination, and it just ain't so. And he spent a large portion of the rest of his time as editor-in-chief of the Midlothian Mirror investigating and printing the results of his investigations on the Kennedy assassination, and they have been compiled as the Forgive My Grief series.
Also, he had a newsletter for many years called The Continuing Inquiry, and for those who would like to read more about Penn as an individual, there's a biography of him called Citizen's Arrest, and I believe the author's last name is Nash. You may be able to dig that up.
This particular section is subtitled Munitions Maker's Secret Police Agency Supplies $6 Million to Benson. It's dated April 9th of 1970. Munition Maker's Secret Police Agency Supplies $6 Million to Benson. And this, of course, B-E-N-T-S-E-N, Lloyd Benson, is who is being talked about here. The Defense Industry Security Command, again, DISC, D-I-S-C, now known as D-I-S, highly secret police agency of the U.S. munitions makers has taken over $6 million of the American people's tax money and funneled it into the most lavish campaign ever recorded for Benson's Senate race. Defense Industrial Security Command is the most undemocratic, dangerous, and unauthorized secret police of every weapons supplier to the Pentagon, with national headquarters at 3990 East Broad Street, Columbus, Ohio. Defense Industrial Security Command, or DISC, is the vehicle which ties each separate munitions and weapons supplier together as a national cartel similar to the Krupps of Germany. And, of course, for those of you who haven't heard that before, K-R-U-P-P, the Krupp family was the munitions family cartel of Germany before both world wars and right on through. Continuing in Penn Jones, Benson is giving, among other things, in exchange for the $6 million by constantly blasting all the, quote, peaceniks in his campaign. The funneling of the prodigious funds to Lloyd Benson's campaign chest is made through the various foundations revealed as CIA conduits during the mid-1960s. Later, the funds will be broken into smaller amounts and attributed as having been donated by numerous corporate officers in Texas. The threatening secret security organization, DISC, is supervised and controlled by the management of the huge corporations manufacturing weapons of sudden violent death, the Defense Intelligence Agency, or DIA, the Central Intelligence Agency, CIA, and the Espionage Division of the FBI. The Mafia and the Gambling Syndicate are a major force in the operation of DISC through their controlling ownership in a number of the major death-dealing munitions corporations. Benson came off the board of directors of Lockheed, one of the largest munitions and supplies contractors, with a fat supply of cash in hand, and promptly began the most expensive campaign ever experienced, even in Texas, where DISC had previously furnished cash to John Connally and lesser amounts to other favored candidates. Ralph Yarborough was puzzled as to the source of such unlimited funds, but he is suspicious of the unprecedented cash and is inquiring. Yarborough and his supporters were completely unaware of the secret police agency funds because of the cloak-and-dagger operations on U.S. soil. They find it hard to believe that such a sinister force is operational, and much less against them. Ralph Yarborough, by the way, was the person who was running against Benson for Senate. The Defense Industrial Security Command has been in force for at least 15 years and has been the source of campaign funds for congressional candidates favoring weapons supply companies and the Pentagon before. DISC is also furnishing campaign cash for Ronald Reagan in California this year, among others. Make no mistake, DISC and its supervisors is the most powerful and dangerous domestic secret police agency to ever threaten a democratic society. And Benson is criticizing Yarborough for using his senatorial aides in his campaign. This could be a device to take the people's mind off of Benson's $6 million munitions cartel fund. On April 7, 1970, the DISC was first publicly tied to the assassination of President Kennedy. News bulletins revealed suit had been filed in California to force the National Archives to open documents suppressed by J. Edgar Hoover. In the suit, it was revealed that Lee Harvey Oswald called collect to a top agent of the Defense Industrial Security Command in Raleigh, North Carolina. The agency was described as an employee of the Federal Counterintelligence Organization. So, Penn Jones here is talking about, obviously, a 1970 Senate campaign, but as so often the case here, there is no past. It's all just a lead-up to what's going on right now. Lloyd Benson, it is common knowledge, does not share Michael Dukakis' political views on a number of subjects. As a matter of fact, so much so that the Republicans have tried to make a campaign point out of saying, you know, how come Democratic president and vice presidential candidates don't even agree with each other on all these major issues, notably among them support to the Contras, which Lloyd Benson has supported and Michael Dukakis has been publicly opposed to. Now, for those of you out there who are faint of heart, we're not necessarily suggesting that Lloyd Benson is directly in line to, you know, knowing that Michael Dukakis, if elected, is going to be bumped off. We can't go that far, obviously. But certainly, people in the know, people who feel themselves to be the true masters of American politics, know that Lloyd Benson is certainly going to be a lot more sympathetic, just as Lyndon Johnson was, to their program, should he happen through some odd eventuality to come to office, should anything happen to an elected Mike Dukakis.
I think the key terms here are damage control and contingency planning. Also, perhaps networking, our favorite word, a word that perhaps the public would do well to substitute for conspiracy, because really the word conspiracy carries a very negative and frivolous connotation, but everyone knows about networking. That's what yuppies do. Well, that's what I do. Oh, well, yes, of course, they say. So that a good way of representing that. Now, the key points in that article are that the Defense Industrial Security Command, as it was known then, the Defense Investigative Service, as it's known now, is an organization of the federal government, yet it is very secretive. One does not hear about it because it is involved with the physical security of the munitions industry and related organizations such as NASA and the Atomic Energy Commission. Just as significantly, it is riddled and inextricable with organized crime, and in particular what is known as the Syndicate. That is the National Organized Crime Consortium, first forged by Meyer Lansky, in which the Mafia, the Cosa Nostra, among other and more important American organized crime institutions have been forged into really what amounts to a national organized crime monopoly. Many people use the term syndicate and mafia interchangeably. That is a serious error. The Mafia, or Cosa Nostra, is only one element, and by far and away, certainly there are many more important elements of the Syndicate. But that the Syndicate has penetrated the defense industry and the munitions makers to a large extent. This has given it active participation in the Defense Investigative Service, or DISC, as it was known at that time. Now, that is the organization which, as we're going to see, provided large elements to the John F. Kennedy assassination. It also, again, is the organization that essentially underwrote Lloyd Benson's first campaign, and in light of his involvement with the Lockheed Corporation, one of the major backers of DISC, Lloyd Benson certainly would appear to be it would appear that his selection was not accidental or capricious. Now, research credit for the following article goes to May Brussel, the top researcher in this field. Unfortunately, May is near death at this moment from a fast-acting case of cancer. A lot of people have some questions about that. In recent conversations with May, she's dying at the moment. I had not had a chance to speak about research with her this summer while she was undergoing chemotherapy. However, in one of our last visits, we talked briefly about some of the things that have been going on. And May, I talked about the death of Willie Velasquez and my view of his death as an assassination, which helped set Lloyd Benson up behind Michael Dukakis. The connection that we're talking about now is certainly the last connection that is going to be provided to us from May Brussel as a living human being. Her research is going to be turned into a foundation, and all of the work that we have in the past we will continue to rely on, certainly, and her tapes as well. However, as a living person, I think this is reflective of the significance of May's work. It was she that provided me with the information concerning Lloyd Benson. It's been a long time since I'd read the Hudson Valley Chronicle article that I'm about to read you. But again, the significance of May's work, I think, is reflected in this very important connection. Nobody else has discussed the significance of Lloyd Benson's connections to the national security establishment and elements in particular that have been involved in our assassinations. Again, research credit to May Brussel. This is from the Hudson Valley Chronicle, Volume 1, Number 1, from July of 1977. It's an article by David Wemple, W-E-M-P-L-E, headlined, King Assassination Conspiracy Revealed. This concerns the Robert Byron Watson affidavit. We discussed this particular article, and we excerpted it in Radio Free America program number 8 about the assassination of Martin Luther King. Now, Robert Byron Watson was a fellow who was working at the Magellan Art Gallery in Georgia, just outside of Atlanta, and he specifically came across elements of the plot to kill Dr. Martin Luther King. He linked the assassination of Dr. King with what he called a syndicate, which was involved not only with drug trafficking, but gold bullion smuggling as well. Perhaps more ominously, this syndicate was inextricably linked with the U.S. national security establishment, namely the military and the intelligence communities, and in turn appeared to represent, as many of its members themselves boasted, a government within a government. It had documented ties to ultra-right-wing organizations such as the John Birch Society, and as we're going to see, it may very well have intersected with the Defense Industrial Security Command. Recalling, by way of review, a little bit about what the syndicate that David Wemple is talking about here is, reading now from the Hudson Valley Chronicle, the operations into which Robert Byron Watson gradually became involved through this blackmail brought him an ever-increasing knowledge of organized crime and its relationship to the U.S. federal government. Although deeply involved in narcotics-related activities, he steadfastly maintains that he never took an active role in the actual trafficking, and that any evidence, unquote, of this has been fabricated in a successful attempt to have him framed and imprisoned for the knowledge which he possesses. His awareness of drug smuggling activities, however, is substantial. While visiting Southeast Asia and purchasing huge amounts of artifacts for sale at Magellan's, for instance, he noticed that his traveling companion, Bill Jackson, was buying large quantities of teak logs. They were hollowed out at points and filled with narcotics and shipped back to the United States. A good deal of this information was forwarded by Watson to Atlanta Public Safety Commissioner A. Reginald F. Eves, E-A-V-E-S. Eves, whose conscience forced him to launch an investigation of Watson's charges in the summer of 1975, conscience in quotes, conceded that his drug-related data, at least, has proven to be, quote, about 95% accurate, unquote. The leads which Watson has provided in regards to the intimacy between government and syndicate, as well as about their involvement in political assassinations, therefore may well be something to be reckoned with. And one of the interesting elements of this syndicate, which according to the affidavit of Robert Byron Watson, which has been largely confirmed by all of the people who have honestly investigated it, among the people involved with the syndicate, in addition to Lloyd Benson, was the late Representative Larry McDonald, national head of the John Birch Society and the right-wing intelligence organization Western Goals, who died in the KAL 007 provocation.
Okay, continuing. This is under the subheading, Watson is set up. It was also on this journey with Bill Jackson that a comment was made to Watson, which will later become significant, that, quote, President Kennedy was killed because he was conspiring with the communists, unquote. Interestingly, Jackson was indicating not that, quote, pro-communist Oswald had been the assassin, but rather that the assassination was a retaliatory move by reactionary elements within the United States itself. Virtually all of the available evidence points to this very scenario. One example of this concerns the ultra-right links through groups such as the John Birch Society and Minutemen. Not only Larry McDonald, but nearly all of the Magellan partners and their associates were active and influential members of the John Birch Society, and asked Byron if he wanted to join up. He was told by Herman Ballard, alias Herman Jackson, that the paramilitary right not only have secret caches of arms and munitions in every state, but that he could personally visit a hidden practice range and become familiar in the use of automatic weapons, machine guns, grenades, bazookas, artillery rockets, and plastic explosives, quote, just in case the commies or niggers should get out of hand, unquote.
And again, by way of illustrating the ultra right-wing connections to this particular organization and the apparent knowledge about the John F. Kennedy assassination that they maintained. Again, it's interesting to reflect on that last paragraph against the background of the Rex 84 martial law contingency plan as set forth by the Sheehan affidavit of the Christic Institute. Skipping down in the Hudson Valley Chronicle article, this next long section here is going to talk about a number of interesting points. The author, David Wemple, is going to compare many of the aspects of Robert Byron Watson's testimony, or his affidavit, his deposition, with what is known about the Defense Industrial Security Command, or Defense Investigative Service, and its involvement, as it's known today, and its involvement in this country's political assassinations. In particular, we're going to deal with some interesting connections between the John Kennedy assassination and the assassination of Martin Luther King, some connections between people involved in both, or apparently involved in both events, and we're going to take a look at some interesting coincidences, items which in One Step Beyond / Radio Free America parlance would be called food for thought and grounds for further research. Some interesting coincidences and overlapping between, again, the information provided by Byron Watson and what is known about the Defense Industrial Security Command.